You know that feeling when you first wake up?
The alarm just went off?
Yeah, the alarm goes off, the room is totally dark, and for a split second, you just don't know where you are. Or even, like, who you are.
Oh yeah, the classic "Am I still dreaming?" phase.
Exactly. It's that brief moment of total disorientation where the world just feels optional. Like, is that dresser actually there, or is my brain just, painting it into the scene?
Usually we just shake that off.
Right, we grab some coffee and get on with our day. But we have been following a guy who absolutely did not shake it off. He leaned into it hard.
René Descartes, the man who basically turned that morning confusion into a philosophical weapon.
We've been tracking his journey through the meditations, and honestly, it's been a bit of a demolition derby so far.
There's one way to put it, yeah.
I mean, we watched him burn down his entire belief system, his senses, his memory, the physical world, until he was left as nothing but a floating point of consciousness.
The famous "I think, therefore I am."
Right. That was the foundational moment. He found the one thing he couldn't doubt, which is his own existence as a thinking thing. But as we start today's deep dive into Meditations 5 and 6.
Based on the lecture by Arthur Holmes, we should mention.
Yes, based on the Holmes lecture, Descartes has a major, major problem right now.
He is incredibly lonely.
He's so lonely.
He is. I mean, he has proven he exists, but he hasn't proven that anything else does. No sky, no earth, no body, no other
He
people.
is trapped in what philosophers call solipsism, just a mind floating in a void.
So today is the reconstruction phase. We are finishing the mission.
The goal is to rebuild the entire universe,
Right.
prove that God exists again somehow, and finally figure out if, my hands and feet are real or just a hallucination.
It is a massive undertaking. And to understand how he does it, we have to remember the rules of the game he's playing. Descartes is a rationalist.
Okay, let's unpack that term because we throw it around a lot. In casual conversation, rational just means sensible. Like, be rational, don't buy a tiger.
Right, exactly.
But in philosophy, it means something very specific.
It's the opposite of empiricism. An empiricist, which is what most of us are by default, believes that knowledge comes from the senses.
Like, I know fire is hot because I touched it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I know the sky is blue because I see it. It's bottom-up knowledge.
But Descartes doesn't trust his senses yet. Remember, he still thinks an evil demon might be, like, hacking his eyes and ears.
Right, so he has to be a rationalist. He believes in a priori knowledge.
Which means knowledge that comes before experience.
Yes. He thinks you can sit in a pitch-black, silent room, close your eyes, and discover the fundamental truths of the universe just by using pure logic.
Top-down knowledge.
Yeah.
And to show us how this works and why our senses are actually garbage, he uses one of the most famous examples in history.
The piece of honeycomb wax.
The wax. So picture this. Descartes is sitting by the fire. He's holding a piece of fresh wax. It just came from the hive. Describe it for us.
Well, it's very distinct. It's hard and cold to the touch. It has a specific shape, maybe a cube or a rough lump. It smells sweet, like flowers and honey. And if you wrap your knuckle on it, it makes a sharp sound.
So our senses are screaming hard, cold, sweet, noisy. That is what wax is.
But then he moves it closer to the fire.
And the data stream completely changes.
Totally. The wax heats up, it turns into a liquid puddle.
The shape is gone, the size actually expands, the smell evaporates.
And if you try to wrap your knuckle on it now, you're just going to burn your finger and make a splash.
So if I was relying purely on my senses, like an empiricist, I would have to conclude that the object I'm holding now is a completely different object from the one I held a minute ago.
Every single sensory quality has been replaced by its opposite. But you know it isn't a different object.
Right. I know it's the same wax.
This is his breakthrough. Descartes asks, "If my eyes and nose tell me it's different, but my mind knows it's the same, what is the wax, really?"
It isn't the smell. It isn't the hardness.
It isn't the color. It's the concept of the wax.
He calls it a thought object, right?
Yes, a thought object. He strips away all the secondary qualities, the sensory stuff, and looks for what is left. And what is left is simply extension.
Extension. That sounds really technical.
It just means it takes up space. It has length, breadth, and depth. It is flexible and movable.
So Descartes realizes that the essence of matter isn't stuff in the way we usually think of it. The essence of matter is geometry.
It's a weird shift in perspective. When you look at a table, you think of wood, varnish, hardness. Descartes looks at a table and sees a set of coordinates.
He's arguing that physics is actually a branch of mathematics.
In a way, yes. We can't trust the flavor of the world, but we can trust the math of the world. Think about a triangle.
Okay, I'm picturing a triangle.
Now, does a perfect triangle exist in the physical world?
Probably not. If I draw one on paper and zoom in with a microscope, the ink lines are going to be bumpy, the atoms aren't perfectly aligned, it's never actually perfect.
Exactly. You might go your whole life without seeing a truly perfect triangle, but the concept of a triangle is rock solid.
The rule that it has three sides, or that its internal angles add up to 180 degrees.
That is objectively universally true.
It's true whether I'm looking at it or not. It's true on Mars. It's true in a computer simulation.
It is a necessary truth. You don't need to go out and survey a million triangles to know the math works. You know it a priori, by definition.
So Descartes establishes that we have these thought objects, math, logic, geometry, that are real and reliable even if the physical world is totally fake.
And this is the springboard. Because in Meditation 5, he uses this exact same logic, the logic of thought objects, to make a massive pivot.
He goes from geometry to God.
He does.
I have to admit, when I was reading the prep for this, this felt like a huge left turn. We're talking about wax and shapes, and suddenly, boom, proof of God. Why does he need God right now?
Because he's still paranoid. Remember, he has these clear ideas about math. But how does he know he's not crazy?
Oh, right. The evil demon.
How does he know the demon isn't messing with his brain wiring, making him think 2 + 2 = 4 when it's actually 5?
He needs a guarantor. He needs to know the operating system of the universe is valid.
Exactly. If he could prove a perfect God exists, and a perfect God wouldn't be a liar or a deceiver, then he can finally trust his clear thoughts.
God validates the math.
Yes. So the stakes are incredibly high. But how does he prove God exists without leaving his chair?
He can't look at miracles or the beauty of a sunset because he doesn't even believe in the sunset yet.
He uses the ontological argument. And honestly, it drives people crazy because it feels like a word trick.
Mm-hmm.
But follow the logic.
Okay, lay it on me.
It starts with a definition. Just like we define a triangle by its sides, how do we define God?
As a supreme being. The best possible being.
Descartes says God is a perfect being,
mm.
A being that possesses all perfections, omnipotence, omniscience, perfect goodness.
Sure, that's the standard resume.
Now, here is the pivot. Is existence a perfection?
I mean, I'd say so. It's better to exist than not to exist.
Right.
Like, if I promised you $1 million, but then said the only catch is the dollars don't exist, you wouldn't be happy. Imaginary money isn't perfect.
Precisely. Descartes argues that existence is a necessary attribute of perfection. If you tried to conceive of a perfect being that didn't exist, you'd be contradicting yourself.
Because I'd be imagining a being that lacks a massive quality reality.
Yes. So saying God does not exist is a logical error for him. It's like saying a square circle.
He uses the analogy of a mountain and a valley, right? I really like this one.
He says you cannot conceive of a mountain without a valley. Even if no mountain actually exists in the physical world, the concept of uphill is intrinsically linked to the concept of downhill.
You just can't have one without the other.
In the exact same way, you cannot separate the essence of God from the fact of his existence.
Okay, I have to jump in here because this is where I, and I think a lot of listeners, get totally stuck.
It's a tough pill to swallow.
It really feels like he is defining God into existence.
It absolutely does.
I mean, I can imagine a perfect island. Greatest beaches, free drinks, perfect weather, and I can define it as the island that has all perfections, including existence.
But that doesn't mean if you book a flight, the island is actually there.
Exactly. I can define it all day long, but my definition doesn't conjure it into reality.
That is the classic objection. It was actually raised by a monk named Gonillo back in the 11th century, but it applies perfectly here. You can't define things into reality.
So how does Descartes wiggle out of that?
He argues there is a fundamental difference between an island and God. An island is contingent.
Contingent.
It means it might exist or it might not. Its essence is just sand, water, and trees. Existence isn't baked into the definition of island.
Okay, I see.
But God is unique. God is the only being whose essence actually is existence.
So for everything else in the universe, existence is an add-on feature. For God, it's the main ingredient.
That's his argument. Whether it convinces you is another matter. Kant later famously tore this apart. But for Descartes, it worked.
He felt he had proven God with the same certainty that he proved a triangle has three sides.
And once that domino falls, the rest follow.
Right. God exists. God is perfect. A perfect God wouldn't matrix simulation me just for laughs.
Therefore, I can trust my clear thoughts.
And because he can trust his thoughts, he can finally turn his attention to the one thing he has been ignoring for 5 entire meditations, his own body.
Finally. Meditation 6. We're getting our limbs back.
He has spent this whole time as a floating mind. Now he wants to know if he has hands to hold the pen.
And the way he does this is really interesting. He starts analyzing the different things his mind does. And he draws a sharp line between conception and imagination.
This is a crucial distinction that we often miss. Conception is pure understanding. Imagination is making a mental picture.
And the lecture used a great example for this, the Chiliagon.
A thousand-sided figure.
Right. So I can conceive of a Chiliagon. I can do the math on it. I know exactly how the angles work. Intellectually, I get it.
But if I close my eyes and try to imagine it, to actually picture a shape with a thousand distinct sides, I just can't do it.
It just looks like a fuzzy circle.
Exactly. My mind's eye fails.
This tells Descartes something important. Imagination requires effort. It feels like the mind is turning towards something outside itself.
It suggests that there is a body or a brain that is trying to form an image, but it's limited.
Right. So imagination hints that we have a body, but it's not absolute proof.
The smoking gun comes from a different faculty entirely. Sensation.
The feeling of things.
Yeah.
Specifically, the violence of sensation.
On aliens.
Well, think about pain. The lecture used the example of a pain in the toe. Descartes notices that sensation is adventitious.
That's the fancy philosophical word for it comes to us, right? We don't invent it.
Yes. It means it is involuntary. If you stub your toe on the bed frame, you don't choose to feel pain.
You can't just decide, I think I'll skip the throbbing sensation today.
No, it forces itself upon you. It is vivid, specific, and undeniable.
So the logic is, I'm not doing this to myself.
Right. I am a thinking thing, but I am not willing this pain. It's happening against my will.
So the cause must be something external to my mind.
And since we already proved God isn't a deceiver who is beaming pain signals into my head just to mess with me.
The only option left is that there is an actual body, there is an actual toe, and it actually hit a physical bed frame.
Nature teaches us, through these involuntary sensations, that the physical world is real.
But what about other people? I have a body, sure, but do you have a mind?
Ah, the problem of other minds. He uses the argument by analogy.
Which is?
Well, I can't feel your mind. I have no direct access to your consciousness. But I see your body act like my body.
Like if I stub my toe, I yelp. And if I see you stub your toe, you yelp.
Exactly. Since my yelp is connected to an internal feeling of pain, I assume your yelp is too.
That makes sense. It's actually kind of wild to think that was the standard view until the 20th century.
Before ideas like empathy or the I-thou relationship came along, yeah, it was all just logical deduction.
Okay, so we've done it. We have the mind, we have God, we have math, and we have the body. But here is where it gets profound. Descartes says this proves we aren't just a pilot in a ship.
That's the famous metaphor. He says, look, if you were just a mind, a pilot, inside a body, a ship, and the body got hurt, you wouldn't feel it.
Right. If a ship hits a rock, the captain doesn't scream in pain. He just looks at the dashboard and sees a red light blinking hull damage.
He notes it intellectually. Oh, look, there is a hole in the side of my vessel.
But we don't do that. When you stub your toe, you don't calmly note foot damage detected.
You scream, you hop around, you feel the damage from the inside.
So this proves that the mind and body are somehow mixed.
Intermingled is the word he uses. He admits that there is a psychosomatic unity. We feel like one whole thing.
But, and this is the biggest but in the history of philosophy, didn't he just spend the last 4 meditations proving that the mind and the body are 2 totally different substances?
And welcome to the mind-body problem.
He painted himself into a corner.
He really did. This is the grand finale, and it's also a complete disaster. He has split reality into 2 distinct teams.
Team mind thinking, immaterial, takes up 0 space.
And team body material, extended, mechanical, basically a machine made of meat.
So the million-dollar question is, how does the ghost pull the levers of the machine?
Exactly. If my mind has no weight, no mass, and no energy, how does it push my physical neurons to make my arm raise?
It's like trying to move a coffee cup just by thinking at it. It violates the laws of physics.
You can't create motion out of nothing. But Descartes, being the confident genius he was, proposed a specific anatomical solution.
He pointed to a tiny part of the brain called the pineal gland.
The seat of the soul.
I love this part. Of all the parts of the brain, why that little nugget?
It was a geometry decision. Descartes was dissecting brains, and he noticed that everything else is double. Two hemispheres, two eyes, two ears.
But the pineal gland appeared to be singular. It was right in the middle.
So he thought, aha, the soul is one, this gland is one, they must be roommates.
Basically. He thought this was the joystick. And his explanation of how it works sounds like absolute steampunk sci-fi.
He talks about animal spirits.
We have to cut him some slack. They didn't know about electricity or neural firing yet.
True. They believed the nerves were hollow tubes filled with fine, wind-like fluids called animal spirits.
So the theory was the soul, the ghost, wiggles the pineal gland.
Right.
The pineal gland acts like a valve, directing the wind of these spirits down the tubes, which puffs up the muscles like balloons to move the arm.
Essentially, yes. It's a hydraulic system operated by a ghost.
But isn't the pineal gland still a part of the body?
Yes.
So isn't it physical?
Yes, it is.
So we haven't solved anything. How does the ghost wiggle the physical gland?
You have spotted the classic goof, as Arthur Holmes calls it. It solves absolutely nothing.
You've just moved the problem from the whole body to a tiny gland in the brain.
You still have an immaterial thing trying to push a material thing. It's physically impossible.
Yes, yes. It's kind of comforting, in a way. One of the smartest humans who ever lived gets to the end of his masterpiece and just completely whiffs it.
It was such a glaring hole that his successor spent the next century coming up with the wildest theories to fix it. The lecture mentions a few, and they are fascinatingly desperate.
Oh, occasionalism was my favorite. This was Malebranche.
Nicholas Malebranche. He saw the problem mind cannot touch body. So he said, okay, they don't touch.
Wait, so how do I move my arm?
You don't.
I don't.
When you will to raise your arm, God perceives that desire. And God steps in and moves your arm for you.
You're kidding. So God is the puppeteer for every single movement. If I scratch my nose, that's a divine miracle.
Every single action, every moment is God bridging the gap. It's a very busy job.
That seems incredibly inefficient. And then there's Leibniz. He went with pre-established harmony.
The two clocks theory. This is mind-bending. Imagine two perfect clocks wound up at the beginning of time. They tick at the exact same moment. But they aren't connected.
Okay, I'm with you.
Leibniz said God created the mind timeline and the body timeline separately. He programmed them to run in perfect parallel.
So at noon, my mind thinks I'm hungry.
And at that exact same second, your body purely mechanically walks to the fridge.
So they never interact?
Never. It just looks like they do because they are perfectly synced.
That is incredibly complicated, just to avoid admitting we don't know how consciousness works.
It shows you how desperate they were to save Descartes' system. They accepted his split of mind and body, so they had to invent miracles to bridge the gap.
So where does that leave us today? We've gone through the geometry of matter, the definition of God, the proof of our own toes, and the absolute mystery of the pineal gland.
I think the big takeaway is the ambition. Descartes tried to ground all of science and reality in pure reason. He wanted absolute certainty.
And even though the pineal gland stuff was a bust, he kind of succeeded in the big picture, didn't he?
He really did. By separating the mind from the body, he unintentionally gave a huge gift to science. He basically said, the body is a machine. It's just geometry and mechanics.
Which meant doctors and scientists could study the body without worrying about souls or spirits or magic.
Exactly. They could just treat it like a clock that needed fixing. He cleared the path for modern medicine and physics. He let the physical world be physical.
But he left us with the hard problem. Because we still feel like a psychosomatic unity. I don't feel like a ghost in a machine. I feel like me.
And science is still struggling to put those two halves back together. We know how the brain works, the chemistry, the electricity. But we still don't know how that meat generates the feeling of I.
We are absolutely still living in Descartes' shadow, trying to figure out how the pilot talks to the ship.
Hopefully without the animal spirits this time.
I think that's the ultimate takeaway for you listening. Think about your own conscious experience. Are we just biological machines tricking ourselves into feeling unified? Or is there some undiscovered law of physics that bridges the immaterial mind and the material brain?
It's the greatest mystery we carry around with us every day.
I'm going to go check my pineal gland now. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, everyone. Stay curious.